say stay away until situation under control. Military presence? Rumors of a protest at Barrel Key. But by then, the interference was too great, and they were listening to some old-timey singer warbling about heartbreak. Gemma punched the radio off. She needed silence to think. There was a fire at Spruce Island, possibly an attack. But by whom? And what did it mean? Why would anyone attack a research institute? She thought of the man who'd grabbed her in the parking lot, with his coffee stink breath and the wide frenzy of his eyes. Barrel Key, Pete said slowly. For once, he wasn't smiling or twitching or trying to make her laugh. He was just frowning, holding tight to the steering wheel with both hands.
That's where you're going, isn't it?
That's where you're going to take me, Gemma said. And maybe it was the way she said it, or the way she looked. But he finally stayed quiet after that. They got to Barrel Key just after 6 o'clock. Gemma had powered down her phone hours earlier, after sending a single text to her mom. Gone to see April in Florida, just so Christina wouldn't be tempted to call out the police or the National Guard. Still, she knew her mom would be frantic. She had probably called Gemma's dad by now, too, and this gave Gemma her only satisfaction. He was thousands and thousands of miles away and couldn't punish her. Barrel Key was one long chain of warehouses and boat shops, big metal storehouses and bait and tackle shacks leaning over on their foundations. The sky, she noticed, was greenish, and only when she rolled her window down and the acrid smell of burning reached her did she realize that the wind had carried ash from Spruce Island.
"Wow,"
Pete said as they passed a single motel. The M in its sign burned out, buzzing the word vacancy at them like a threat.
Great vacation spot. Very, authentic.
It's more of a working vacation, she said, because she knew he wouldn't drop it otherwise.
What kind of work? You a world-class fly fisherman or something? Or trying to re-up on ammunition?
This, as they were passing a lean-to advertising both farm-fresh eggs and major firearms.
Do you want to tell me what you're really doing here?
Gemma hesitated. I can't, she said. It wasn't a lie. She didn't know exactly what she expected to find, only that the universe seemed to be pointing here, toward Haven. A battered sign showed the way to the marina. Turn right here. She kept the window down, straining for a glimpse of Spruce Island, but the buildings kept intruding, and the ocean was only visible in brief flashes. Here, at least, the town was not nice exactly, but nicer. Another motel, this one with all its letters intact, diners and bars, stores with colorful lures displayed in the windows, a t-shirt shop, and a restaurant with outdoor seating. In the distance, she heard a sound she thought must be the roar of waves, but as they grew closer, she made out human voices. A helicopter passed overhead, then another. The road curved, and they were prevented from going any farther by a series of sawhorses in the road, and cops grimly gesturing them to turn around. Beyond the roadblock was the marina, and hundreds of people gathered there, shouting and chanting and waving homemade signs. Beyond them, the spiky mass of small sailboats bobbing up and down in the water. A column of smoke was visible here, tufting up into the sky from somewhere up the coast and smearing the sun to a strange orange color. A cop rapped on the driver's side window, and Pete rolled it down.
"You're going to have to turn around," the cop said.
He was suited up in riot gear and carrying three guns that Gemma could see. "That's where we're going," Gemma said, gesturing to the angry crowd at the marina. And Pete gave her a look like, "We are?"
"Turn around," the cop said. "Nothing to see here."
"Except for the huge fireball and all the people going nutty," Pete said.
Gemma elbowed him as the cop leaned down to stare at them through the window. But otherwise you're right. Nothing to see. Nothing at all. A second cop was moving toward them, and Pete quickly put the car in reverse. Have a nice day, he shouted, even as he was backing haphazardly up the street. The two cops stood there, staring after them, until they'd turned around in the parking lot of a hardware store and started back in the direction they'd come.
Well, that was a lovely day trip, Pete said as they left the marina behind. Where to now? Any natural disasters you want to visit? Prison camps? Political riots?
Gemma spotted a vacant parking lot behind a long line of low-ceilinged storage units. Pull over here, she said. Pete turned to stare at her.
Are you serious?
Please, just do it. It felt good to give orders, to have a plan, to be out on her own, to do what she wanted without having to beg for permission. Something leapt to life in her chest, a force beyond the guilt and the fear. It was like she'd been living in a cartoon, in two dimensions, her whole life, and had just fought free of the page. He did, barely making the turn, and rolled to a stop.
Most people think of spring break. They think bikinis, virgin piña coladas, spray tans.
Not me, Gemma said, trying to make a joke of it. I'm allergic to coconut, and I don't even own a bikini.
Why not?
His eyes were very clear when he turned to look at her.
You'd look great in a bikini.
Once again, she couldn't tell whether he was making fun of her. There was an awkward second when Gemma was acutely aware that she was imagining Pete, imagining her in a bikini, fat rolls and thighs that rubbed together and everything. She wanted to die of embarrassment. Her cheeks felt like someone had put a torch to them. She could hardly stand to look at him, but she had to know whether he was smirking. He wasn't. He was fiddling nervously with the radio, even though he'd shut off the car ignition. It occurred to Gemma that he was nervous, actually nervous, because of her. Germ Ives, the Frankenstein monster. I'll be fine, she said, and opened the car door. She didn't know where all the tension had come from, but she was desperate to escape it. Her whole body was torch hot now. Immediately, the faint scent of burning reached her, and beneath it, the smell of swampland, sun-baked mud and belly-up fish and microorganisms wiggling deep in the earth. Thanks for the ride. Really.
You are serious, he said,
as though he couldn't believe it. He raised his hands.
All right, whatever gets your goat.
Whatever gets your goat? She shook her head, amazed.
Yeah, you know, whatever wets your whistle, gets your rocks off, brings you to your happy place.
Pete, she said, but she couldn't help but smile. Know when to stop. Seriously. She got out of the car, half expecting him to call her back. But he popped the trunk when she rapped on it, and she slung her backpack over her shoulder. Still with that weird sense of guilt and fear arm-wrestling with excitement in her stomach. Pete rolled down the window and called out to her before she could walk away.
You'll call me, right? If you need anything?
Is this your fancy way of getting my number? Gemma asked. Immediately she wanted to chew her own lips off. She sounded like such a dork, and she hated herself for caring, too. He'd given her a ride, and that was it. It wasn't like they'd been on a date.
Technically, he said, it's my fancy way of making you ask for my number.
He smiled at her all crookedly, with his hair standing up as if it was happy, too. She took his number down, and he took hers.
Promise you'll call, all right? So I know you didn't end up, you know, eaten by a crocodile or something.
She promised she would, although she knew she wouldn't. Besides, he was just being polite. She stood there and waved goodbye, feeling a quick squeeze of regret as Pete bumped off onto the road in his ridiculous van. If she was honest, she had to admit she hadn't hated hanging out with him. He was annoying, obviously. She didn't like the way that he looked at her sometimes, as if his eyes were lasers boring straight into her brain. But he was funny, and he was company, and he was, okay, maybe kind of cute. She'd never even been alone with a boy before today. Now, she was definitely alone. She turned back toward the marina. As soon as she began walking, she regretted telling Pete to drop her off so far away. She couldn't approach the marina head-on. She had no desire for FaceTime with RoboCop and his buddy, but she figured if she could find a different route onto the beach, she could make her way back along the water to the place where everyone had gathered. Then, she hoped, she'd be able to figure out what had happened at Haven. What Haven was, even. When she could hear the noise of the protest, she turned left and cut through a rutted, salt-worn alley between two boat shops, and then right on a street parallel to the one that led to the marina. Beach grass grew between cracks of the asphalt, and a fine layer of sand coated the sidewalks. The houses here were interspersed with smoke shops and dingy bodegas, each of them painted a different pastel, but also dusty and dim-looking, like old photographs leached of their luster. After another minute, the buildings fell back and she saw the water flashing behind sawgrass, the color of spun caramel. A chain-link fence blocked passage down to the beach, and beyond it she saw rusted kayaks piled in the grass and a scattering of broken beer bottles and cigarettes. She looked behind her. No movement in any of the houses. No signs of life at all except for a skinny cat slinking out from underneath an old Toyota Corolla. Several more helicopters motored by overhead. She removed her backpack and heaved it over the fence, and then, checking once again to make sure no one was looking, interlaced her fingers in the chain link and began to climb. The fence swayed dangerously, and she had a momentary vision of toppling backward and pulling the whole fence with her. She maneuvered clumsily over the top of the fence and then dropped to the sand, breathing hard now and sweating under the strange, smoky sun. She picked up her backpack, realizing as she did that she could now see Spruce Island in the distance, or at least what she thought must be Spruce Island. About a mile up the coast, she could make out a range of heavy dark growth above the horizon. The rest of the island, and whatever Haven was or had been, was blurred by a scrim of smoke and heat. She picked her way along this untended portion of beach back toward the marina, watching her feet so she didn't trip on any of the junk embedded in the sand. She came to another chain-link fence, this one running down into the water, but luckily found a gate unlatched and didn't have to climb again. Then she was in front of a battered gray warehouse. She'd seen it at an angle from Pete's car, and knew that it extended like a long arm to brace one side of the marina. And now the swell of voices reached her over the wind. She had to slosh down into the mud to get around the old warehouse, and every time she stepped, a few inches of filthy water swirled up around her shoes. On the far side of the warehouse was the parking lot the police had blocked off, and the crowd had assembled there, some people carrying signs and chanting in unison, some camped out on the asphalt with picnic blankets and binoculars, like they were at a summer concert. A few kids Gemma's age, or slightly older, were grouped along the edge of a neighboring roof, legs dangling like icicles from the eaves, watching the action. Gemma counted 50 people and at least a dozen cops. What was going on at Haven that it would be so worth protecting or destroying? She slipped unnoticed into the crowd. She passed a man wearing a plastic Viking helmet that had been outfitted with different antennae and metal coils. He kept pacing in circles, gesturing to an invisible audience and muttering, and when he caught Gemma looking, he whirled on her and continued his monologue even more loudly. "And why we couldn't drink any of the water when we were stationed in Nasiriya, fear of poison. Of course, some must have gone in the food supply, and that's why the doctor says holes in my brain."
she turned quickly away. Several people wore gas masks that made them look like the bad guys in a horror film, or like enormous insects, which made it even weirder that they were standing around in jeans and beat-up topsiders, gazing out over the water. The protesters, she saw, were calling for Haven shuttering. "Our land, our health, our right," read one sign, and another said, "Keep your chemicals out of my backyard." But among them were signs with other, stranger messages, signs that referenced Roswell and Big Brother and zombies, and several posters screaming about the dangers of hell. One girl who couldn't have been older than 12 was holding a colorful handmade sign with bubbly letters. "And cast ye the unprofitable servant into outer darkness." Gemma picked out a sunburned, middle-aged couple who looked normal enough and fought her way over to them. The man wore leather sandals and a baseball hat with the logo of a hunting lodge on it. The woman was wearing a fanny pack. Both of them were staring out toward the billowing clouds of smoke in the distance, which made it look as if a volcano had erupted mid-ocean. "What's going on?" Gemma asked them. It was funny how disasters made friends of everyone. "Is anyone saying how the fire started?" The man shook his head.
"Nothing official. Heard maybe a gas line blew up. Of course, the island's loaded with chemicals. Would have caught fast."
His wife snorted.
"It was no gas line," she said. "We've talked to a dozen locals, say they heard at least two explosions, one right after another."
"Explosions?" Gemma repeated, shifting the backpack strap on her shoulder. Sweat had gathered under the collar of her shirt.
"Like a bomb or something?"
The woman gave Gemma a pitying look.
"You're not from around here, are you? People have been calling for the Institute, or whatever it is, to be shut down for years now. I wouldn't be surprised if someone decided to take a shortcut. Of course, the rumors..." She spread her hands.
"What kind of rumors?" Gemma pressed. Although she remembered from the Haven files a long list of all the different things supposedly manufactured at Haven, everything from incredibly contagious diseases to human organs.
"Some people think they got aliens out there on that island," the husband said.
Now Gemma understood the reference to Roswell, where an alien spaceship had supposedly crashed and then been concealed by the military.
"Well, I tell you, we come up every year from Orlando to do a little paddling and bird watching in the reserve. Great birds up here. White ibis, knots, and dowitchers on the old oyster bars. You interested in birds?"
Gemma arranged her face into what she hoped was a polite expression and nodded. He harrumphed as if he didn't believe it, and went on.
"I've got a pair of binoculars, can spot a pine grosbeak at a distance of 800 yards, and I've done a little sighting of the island, and never seen any glowing green men."
He kept his eyes on the fire in the distance.
"But I'll tell you, they have guards and mounted towers, barbed wire fences 16 feet high. They'll shoot you if you get too close and won't blink about it. They say they're doing medical research out there, stuff for our boys overseas. But I don't buy it. They're hiding something, that's for sure."
Another chopper went by overhead, and Jem felt the staccato of its giant rotor all the way in her chest. It seemed obvious that no one knew what was happening, or had happened, out in Haven. But still, she fought through the crowd, searching for an official, for someone in charge. Forcing her way through the knot of protesters, she saw a policeman arguing with a dark-haired boy with the kind of symmetrical good looks that Gemma associated with movies about superheroes. The cop was holding a professional-looking camera and appeared to be deleting pictures.
"No right to confiscate it," the boy was saying as Gemma approached. "That's private property."
"What did I say about taking pictures?"
the cop said, angling away and blocking the boy with his shoulder when he tried to reach for his camera.
"This isn't the goddamn Grand Canyon. We've got an emergency on our hands. Show some respect."
Gemma couldn't help but feel sorry for the boy. He looked furious. He couldn't have been much older than she was, and the camera looked expensive.
"I'm not a tourist," he said, "and I can take pictures if I want to. This is America."
"This is a crime scene, at least until we say otherwise," the cop said. The boy clenched his fists. Gemma found herself momentarily frozen, watching him. For a second, his eyes ticked to hers, but they swept away just as quickly. She wasn't offended. She was used to being invisible to other people, preferred it even.
"All right,"
the cop had finished with the camera. He popped open the back of the camera, removed the battery, and then returned the now useless camera to Jake.
"Now for your phone, please."
"You can't be serious."
The boy had gone completely white. Gemma was getting angry on his behalf. Why wouldn't he have the right to take pictures if he wanted to? The cop was obviously losing patience. He raised a finger and jabbed it right in the boy's face.
"Now look here, son."
"My name is Jake," the boy said smoothly. "Jake Witz."
"All right, Jake Witz. You want to make trouble? You just keep on yapping. But I'll bring you down to the station."
"For what? Having an iPhone?"
"That mouth is gonna get you into trouble."
Gemma was too stunned to move. Jake Witz was the name of the guy who ran the Haven Files website. It had to be a coincidence. He bore no resemblance to the guy in the profile picture on the site. This guy looked like he could be a Clark Kent body double, just without the glasses. And yet, when she looked closer, she thought she saw certain similarities. The line of the boy's jaw, which in the older man had been blurred. The same slightly too large nose, which on the boy looked strong and perfect, and on the older man had just looked comical. Relatives, then? She couldn't be sure. Finally, the boy had no choice but to pass over his phone. The cop made Jake unlock the screen and then sorted through the pictures, deleting the ones he deemed inappropriate. Jake stood there, his face hard with anger, which somehow made him even more attractive. Finally, the cop returned the phone and gave Jake a big thump on the back, as if they were best friends at a baseball game.
"Good man," he said. "Now don't make me ask you again, all right? Clear on out of here. Nothing to see."
Almost immediately, the cop swaggered away, pushing roughly past Gemma without sparing her a second glance, this time to yell at two teenage girls who were trying to record a video with their phones. Jake aimed a kick at a crushed Coca-Cola can, which skittered across the sand and gravel and landed in a patch of grass. Either he hadn't noticed Gemma, or he was pretending not to have. So she cleared her throat. "Jake? Jake Witz?" He looked up finally, and her heart stuttered. His eyes were large and dark and mournful, and reminded her of the way Rufus looked when no one was paying him any attention.
"Yeah,"
he said. He sounded tired. He looked tired, too, and she wondered how long he'd been out here, watching. "My name's Gemma Ives," she said. She realized she hadn't exactly planned what she was going to say. She still didn't know what connection this Jake Witz had to the guy who ran the Haven Files, or whether there was a connection. If he recognized her last name, he gave no indication of it. "I know you. Well, I know of you. You're from the Haven Files, right?" He frowned.
"The website was my dad's thing," he said. "I have nothing to do with it."
He started to turn away. "You must have something to do with it," Gemma said. The words leapt out of her mouth before she could stop them. Slowly, he turned back to face her.
"What's that supposed to mean?"
Gemma licked her lips. "You're here, aren't you?" she said. "We're about as close as we can get to Haven. You're taking pictures. You must be interested, at least a little." He didn't agree, but he didn't deny it either. He just stood there, watching her. Gemma couldn't tell whether he found her amusing or irritating. His face was too perfect. It was unreadable. Just being around him made her feel like she was fumbling her way through a restaurant that was far too fancy for her. She found if she avoided looking directly in his eyes and instead focused her attention on his nose or eyebrows or cheekbones, she could at least think. "Look," she said, "I came all the way from North Carolina. My dad was involved with Haven somehow, or at least people think he was involved. He's not scared of anything, but he's scared of that. I want to know why. I have to know what they do at Haven. I have to know why it matters to him. And to me," she added silently. For a long time, Jake said nothing. Then, just for a second, a smile went fast across his face.
"Not by a long shot," he said,
so quietly that Gemma wasn't sure he meant for her to hear. He started to turn around again, and Gemma's heart sank.
"What did you say?"
She was sure now that fate had led her here, to Jake Witz. Sure that no matter what he claimed, he knew the truth about Haven.
"You said we were as close as we could get to Haven, but we're not. Not even close."
He inclined his head, and Gemma recognized the gesture for what it was, an invitation. He wanted her to follow him. This time, his smile was real and long, and nearly blinded her.
"Come on, Gemma Ives. I've been in the sun all day. I could do with a waffle."
Jake explained that there were two ways out to Haven. One was to take a launch from Barrel Key and circle around to the far side of the island, where the coast dissolved into open ocean, staying clear of the marshes. This was the way the passenger boats ferried employees back and forth, and the way that freight was moved. No boat of any size could navigate the marshes. But there was another way, the Wali River, which passed the tiny fishing village of Wali and fanned out into the marshes. Miles of winding, narrow channels and half-submerged islands that reached nearly all the way to Haven's northern coast.
"How do you know all this?" Gemma asked.
They'd found a diner tucked off the main drag, empty except for a mom and her toddler, and two older men in hunting vests huddled over coffee, with faces so chewed up by wind and weather, it looked like their skin was in the process of dissolving. Although from here, the ocean was invisible. There was still a rubber stink smell in the air, and they could hear the occasional threshing of helicopters overhead. Jake lined up four containers of half and half and emptied them one by one into his coffee.
"I've lived in Little Waller my whole life," he said. "That's 40 miles from here. My dad was big into fishing, camping, that kind of thing. We used to camp on the Wali. Spruce Island used to be owned by some timber company, but Haven bought them out to build the institute. I remember they were still doing construction on some of the buildings when I was a kid." He shrugged. "Maybe that's when his obsession started. I never got the chance to ask."
Gemma swallowed.
"Is he...
dead?"
Jake said matter-of-factly, without looking at her. He stirred his coffee with a spoon, but didn't drink.
"Died 4 years ago, when I was 14. Drowned in the marshes. That's what they said, anyway."
Gemma felt suddenly cold.
"What do you mean?"
Jake just shook his head. He leaned forward on his elbows, staring out the window, and was quiet for a bit. A small TV mounted above the coffee pot was tuned to the news and kept scanning across the marina they'd just left behind. The waitress, a woman with hair shellacked into a bun, was parked in front of the TV with her arms crossed.
"I never really understood my dad," Jake said.
His voice was rough, as if it were sliding over gravel.
"He wasn't like the other dads. He worked at one of the plants cleaning out fish guts, but he carried a business card everywhere like he was the President of the United States or something. Never left the house without a blazer, no matter what else he was wearing, Bermuda shorts or a bathing suit. He was always talking about his theories. He talked so goddamn much. He used to joke that's why my mom left, because she couldn't stand the talk. But I don't know. He might have been right. As a kid, I just wanted him to shut up sometimes, you know?
He leaned back, meeting Gemma's eyes again, and she was startled by their darkness, their intensity. She couldn't help thinking that Jake and Pete were complete opposites. Pete walked like he was jumping. Jake, as if the gravity were double for him what it was for anyone else. Pete was all lightness. Jake, all weight.
I was ashamed of him, you know? Even as a kid, I was ashamed. Does that make me a bad person?
No, Gemma whispered. He smiled as if he didn't believe her. He was neatening his empty plate, lining up his silverware with the table, his cup and saucer with the plate. He was the neatest eater Gemma had ever seen. She was embarrassed to see a ketchup blob and some crumbs by her elbow, and quickly wiped them up when he wasn't looking.
My dad liked to say he missed his calling as a journalist. He always saw cover-ups, conspiracies, that kind of thing. JFK was killed because he was about to do a public memorandum on sentient life on other planets. Chickenpox was actually a biological agent released from a government lab. But Haven. Haven was his white whale.
Jake pressed his hands flat against the table, hard, as if he could squeeze the memory of his father out through his palms. Even his fingers were perfect.
He used to take me with him on fishing trips out on the marshes. Or at least, I thought they were fishing trips at first.
Reconnaissance, Gemma said.
Jake nodded. Being on the marshes is like being inside a maze. Red maple and cord grass, needle rush, palmetto. It grows 10-12 feet high and swallows up the horizon. My dad had friends who'd gotten lost for hours, even days out there, floating around trying to lick water from plant leaves and eating grubs for dinner. And there they were, not a half mile from camp. Once we got really close, within shouting distance of the island, well, all of a sudden there must have been 8-10 guards with guns, shouting for us to turn around and head back. My dad was furious. I was just a kid, you know. They acted like they were about to blow our heads off. They probably would have. They fired on people before, civilians. I know a fisherman from town says he almost got a hand blown off. Says he thinks it must have been a sniper to get him from that distance. Of course, they're all from the military.
He shook his head, smiling faintly.
In all the years I've lived down here, I know of only one person who made it onto the island. Some kid snuck under a bad bit of fence in the middle of the night. Got chucked out just as quickly.
Gemma was having trouble following everything that Jake was saying, but she understood the main points. Crazy tight security, no one allowed to talk.
What about the people who work out there? She asked. The guards and the staff. Someone must be going on and off the island.
Jake nodded.
Freight goes in and out, sure, and trash gets collected on Sundays, but no one goes past the gate. The staff goes out on launches from town. Some of them live there and come back to the mainland on leave. Some of them commute. But they won't talk. They won't say a word about what goes on there. Like they're all scared.
He took a breath.
Everyone except for Nurse M.
Nurse M? Gemma repeated. Who's Nurse M?
I wish I knew.
This time Jake's smile was crooked, as if he was too tired to make it line up.
Before he died, my dad said he was working some big angle. He said he was going to blow the lid off the whole operation. That's how we talked, you know, like we were all cast members of some Hollywood spy movie.
A look of pain seized him momentarily.
He told me he'd found a woman, Nurse M, who'd agreed to talk to him. She wanted everyone to know the truth. But the day before they were supposed to meet up, she died. Killed herself, allegedly.
He straightened his fork and knife again, avoiding Gemma's eyes. Although it was warm in the diner, Gemma felt as if a cold tongue had just licked the back of her neck.
But
You don't believe that, she said slowly, watching him. He shrugged. You think she was murdered? So she wouldn't be able to talk? Now he picked at the surface of the table with a thumbnail.
I don't know. But it looks strange, doesn't it?
He shook his head. My dad left notes. Tons and tons of notes about Haven. Some of them nonsensical. Some of them just irrelevant. I never found her real name. He was trying to protect her, I think. But he failed. Gemma felt suddenly nauseous. Her father was wrapped up in this. Her family was wrapped up in it. You said they told you your father drowned. You don't believe it. She was afraid to ask, but she had to know. He looked down at his lap.
After that time we almost got shot, my dad stopped taking me with him when he went out on the marshes. He was scared. But he was getting closer, too. I know that now. He died only 2 months after Nurse M was found hanging. That's no coincidence.
A muscle in his jaw twitched.
I still remember the smell of that morning, like this kind of aftershave one of the cops was wearing. Isn't that crazy? I can't remember his face, but I remember his goddamn aftershave.
He laughed softly. She had the urge to reach out and take his hand, but of course she didn't.
I was 14. They told me he'd been fishing when a storm blew in. Said he must have flipped his kayak, got turned around.
And what do you think? Gemma said. He looked up. His eyes were like twin holes. There was so much pain at the bottom of them. Gemma wanted to look away, but couldn't.
My dad was a lot of things, he said softly. But he wasn't an idiot. He could navigate those marshes blindfolded. He was happier on the water than anywhere else. He said it was the only place he belonged, you know?
He looked away again. Gemma wondered what it would be like to lose a parent so young, and found she couldn't imagine it. Would she be unhappy if her father died? She had always fantasized about simply deleting him from her life, pressing backspace and watching him vanish. But the truth, of course, was more complicated than that. "What do you think really happened?" she asked. He sighed.
"I think he made it," he said. "I think he got onto the island, and then I think he was caught. They would have made it look like an accident."
Gemma felt as if there were a spider caught in her throat, trying to claw its way up her windpipe. She didn't want to believe any of it. But she did. "Do you know what they do at Haven?" Gemma asked. It was the question she'd come to Florida to answer. The only question that mattered.
"No," Jake answered bluntly, and Gemma's heart fell. "But I have some idea."
She waited, almost afraid to breathe. Jake looked around the diner as though trying to judge whether they were safe. No one was paying them any attention. "Still," he called out to the waitress.
"Excuse me, would you mind turning up the volume?"
he said. She barely glanced at him before punching up the volume on the remote. A bug-eyed woman behind a news desk was staring earnestly into the camera, and for a moment, Gemma latched onto her voice. "Dr. Mark Saperstein, who is listed as the current director of the Haven Institute, cannot be reached for comment. It is unknown whether he too was on the island when the explosion..." Jake leaned forward and cleared his throat.
"Human experimentation."
"What?" Gemma looked away from the TV, which was again showing images of the coastline and the sun setting behind a veil of smoke. Jake shoved his hand through his hair.
"Human experimentation. I know it sounds crazy," he added, before Gemma could say it. "And I'm not talking about your usual drug trials either. I'm talking illegal experimentation. Weapons development. Chemical trials. That's why all the security, and why they're so far out of the way. No oversight."
Gemma frowned. Every medication or treatment that went to market had to go through human clinical trials. Gemma's dad was always railing against the medical ethics board's short-sightedness and how difficult it was to drum up volunteers for certain treatments. He was convinced that thousands of people died every year because the drugs that could have saved them were still being reviewed for safety by the FDA or hadn't been approved yet for human trial. Could Haven be a place designed so researchers could skirt the normal rules and do their work with no oversight? She could understand, if so, why her father might have refused to pour money into Haven and might have left Fine and Ives before his name could be associated with the deal. There had never been a bigger fan of rule-following than Jeffrey Ives. Still, the whole thing was pretty far-fetched, and it wouldn't explain why Gemma's father was so afraid. If he really had refused to participate, if he'd left his own company just to avoid the association with Haven, he would be praised as a hero. "Where do they get the volunteers?" she asked. Her coffee was cold by now, but it was comforting to hold the mug between her palms. Jake bit his lip, looking at her sideways.
"That's the point," he says. "I don't think they're volunteers."
Gemma stared at him. "What do you mean?"
"They're not getting volunteers. Not for these experiments. They're forcing people to participate."
"But how?" Gemma asked. The French toast she'd eaten seemed to be sticking in her throat. "They can't just, I don't know, kidnap people."
"Why not?" Jake leaned forward. "Look, Gemma, this was my dad's work. This was his life. However nuts it sounds, I think he was onto something. Fine and Ives has military contracts, money coming directly from the top. Half of Fine and Ives's budget comes from military contracts. This is the government we're talking about."
Gemma thought of her father and his old company, and her stomach squirmed. She remembered Christmas parties as a kid at the Carolina Inn, the ceiling draped in tinsel and plastic snowflakes, and everyone standing to applaud her father as he entered, clutching Gemma's hand. She remembered visiting the White House with her dad on a trip to D.C., and how he shook the president's hand, and Gemma and her mother got to go downstairs to play ninepins in the White House bowling alley. And men suited up in crisp uniforms pinned with shiny medals, going in and out of her father's office, smiling at her, hefting her into the air, tossing and catching her with big, muscled arms. Jake leaned forward, lowering his voice.
"You've heard of Dr. Saperstein?"
Gemma nodded. She remembered reading that Dr. Saperstein had taken control of Haven after Richard Haven had died in a car accident, the very same year she was born. The coincidence now seemed ominous.
"About 15 years ago, Saperstein weaseled his way onto the board of a non-profit called the Home Foundation up in Philadelphia. It still exists today,"
he added, when Gemma shook her head to show she hadn't heard of it.
"He spent a few years growing its operations, expanding the volunteer forces, crowing about it in the media. Anyway, my dad dug up all the details. The Home Foundation places kids in foster care. These are the worst cases, children who've bounced around for years or got dumped in front of the fire station or the hospital. It was the perfect setup. Kids get shuffled and reshuffled, moved around, drop out of the system, run away, disappear. Nobody's going to look too hard for them, right?"
Gemma felt now as if her thoughts were all gummed up and sticky. Maple syrup brain. "I don't get it," she said. "What are you saying? You can't mean..." She took a deep breath. "They're not doing experiments on kids."
"They're only doing experiments on kids," Jake said gently, almost apologetically, Gemma thought. "I think Saperstein stole them. He stole them and brought them to Haven. That's why all the security. It's not just to keep us out, you know. Not by a long shot. It's to keep them in.
Gemma felt dizzy, even though she hadn't moved. It was too terrible. She didn't want to believe it. She wouldn't believe it.
There's no proof, she said. Her voice sounded tinny and far away, as if she was hearing it through a pipe.
Jake turned to look out the window. The smoke was still smudging the horizon, turning the setting sun to a smoldering orange. He said something so quietly Gemma nearly missed it.
Nearly.
Suddenly, her heart was beating so hard it felt as if it might burst through her chest.
What? She said. What did you just say?
He sighed. This time, when he looked at her, she was afraid.
I saw them, he repeated.
How?
Gemma felt like she was choking.
Remember that boy I told you about? The one who made it onto Haven through the fence?
Jake half smiled.
I was the boy.
Gemma. Chapter 8. The Two Bass Motel was just outside of town, a long, low, shingle-sided building with only a single car in the parking lot. When Gemma requested a room, the ancient owner knocked over her tea in surprise, as if she'd never before heard the words. But the room was clean, although slightly musty-smelling, and decorated, predictably, with lots of fish. An itchy coverlet woven with images of leaping salmon, a framed picture of fly-fishing hooks above the TV, a plastic bass mounted on the wall in the bathroom. Gemma hoped it wasn't the singing kind. They had agreed that Jake would come back for her at 11 o'clock, and Gemma wasn't sure what was making her so nervous. The idea of trying to sneak into Haven, as Jake had done only once before, or the idea of being alone with him in the dark. Alone with those perfect hands and eyes and lashes and fingernail beds. She'd never even noticed fingernail beds before, but she'd noticed his. She powered on her phone. There was a sudden frenzied beeping as a dozen texts and voicemails loaded, and she was surprised to see among all the messages from her mom that Pete had already texted her. You didn't get eaten by an alligator, did you? For a quick second, she actually felt guilty, as if she was cheating on Jake. Then, of course, she felt like an idiot, a delusional idiot. She wrote back, I'd like to see one try. Then she dialed April's number. April picked up on the first ring and was talking before Gemma could even say hello.
Thank God, finally. I've been calling you for like 5 hours. I thought you said your parents caved, but your mom is freaking out. She said you basically ran away. I mean, seriously, I'm talking about National Guard Armageddon-level freakout. If screaming were a superpower, she'd seriously be eligible for her own franchise. Did you tell her I was with you? Gemma asked quickly. The idea of her mother screaming, or even raising her voice, was both difficult to imagine and also terrifying. Her dad was the screamer. Her mom was the apologizer, the mediator, the smoother over. The nothing a glass of wine and a Klonopin can't fix kind of person. April snorted.
Do you think I'm a complete amoeba?
Of course I did. Except I started running out of reasons you wouldn't come to the phone. First, I said you were napping, then that you'd gone out for a swim, then that you were in town getting coffee, and then I had to stop picking up the phone. I'm talking serious harassment here. She's probably called like 20 times. I'll call her, okay? I'll call her right now, Gemma said. And April let out a big whoosh of air.
Please, she said, before your mom calls in a SWAT team. My grandpa will kill me if they trample his geraniums.
And then, in a different voice, where are you? Are you okay? How did you even get down here?
I'm in Barrel Key, not far away, Gemma said, avoiding April's last question,
tracing one of the fish patterned on her coverlet with a finger. All the fish were identical, and all of them had the same anatomical error, an extra fin on the back that gave them a vaguely prehistoric look.
"But what are you doing there? I thought you were coming to stay with me."
"I am, tomorrow, and then I'll tell you everything. I promise," Gemma said, before April could protest. She'd already lied so much in the past 24 hours. She couldn't stand lying to April, too. But what could she say to explain?
"Oh, no big deal. Someone threw a Frankenstein mask through our window, and then a random psycho tried to nab me from a gas station, and I think it's because my dad's old company is kidnapping children and testing chemicals on them, and he might have known about it all this time."
"Just trust me, okay?" April sighed.
"Swear you're not holed up in some seedy motel meeting a stranger named Danger 66 who claims to be a French exchange student looking for an English tutor."
Gemma looked around the room and decided it definitely counted as a seedy motel.
"I promise I'm not meeting a stranger named Danger 66, she said. "I promise I'm not meeting any stranger."
Jake Witz blinked momentarily in her mind. But he didn't count. She'd sought him out, not the other way around. Besides, she couldn't believe that someone who looked like Jake Witz could be dangerous. She'd been fed a steady diet of Disney growing up. The evil ones were always ugly. By the same logic, she knew that she was destined to be the charming, dumpy sidekick for life. Only skinny girls got to be leads. Her next phone call went far less smoothly. April was right. Her mom was in full-on panic mode. Gemma had never heard her mother so upset, except for one time when she was a little kid and decided to smash up her mom's favorite necklace with a hammer to see whether diamonds were really the hardest substance on earth.
"I don't believe you. I really don't believe you. I would never have expected it, never in a million years, after we specifically told you, Mom, calm down."
Gemma was annoyed not by the injustice of her parents' rules, but by the fact that her mom had automatically assumed she would always obey. Just like she'd obeyed as a kid, shivering in those hospital beds, swallowing pills when she was told to swallow them, waking up with new scars, new evidence of damage.
"It's not a big deal, okay?" "Not a big deal? Not a big deal?"
Christina seemed to be gasping the words.
"How can you even say that? Do you know how worried I've been? How worried your father's been?"
"Yeah, I'm sure he's been crying into his PowerPoint." The words were out of Gemma's mouth as soon as she thought them. Christina drew in a sharp breath. Then she said in a quiet voice,
"For your information, your father is on his way back from Shanghai right now. As soon as he lands, we're getting on a plane and coming straight down to get you."
"Mom, no." Gemma was surprised that in an instant, all her anger was gone, and instead she was suddenly on the verge of tears. She took a deep breath.
"Please," she said, because she knew that fighting or yelling wouldn't help. "I'm not in trouble. I'm safe. I'm with April."
She no longer felt guilty about lying. If Jake was right about what they were doing at Haven, her father must have known about it and had spent his whole life lying. Her mother, too. It was like she'd heard him say, he'd done nothing.
"Please let me have this. Just this once. Let me be normal."
Christina sighed, and Gemma knew she'd said the right thing. She imagined her mother cradling the phone against one shoulder, unscrewing the cap of one of her pill bottles, and shaking one into her palm, starting to calm down.
"I'll talk to your dad," she said. "But you know how he is. He's furious. You lied to us, Gemma."
"How many times have you lied to me?" Gemma nearly said. But she swallowed the words back. She said instead,
"You didn't give me much choice."
To her surprise, her mother laughed. but it was the saddest laugh ever. Like she really wanted to cry.
"We're just trying to keep you safe, Jem," she said. "That's all we ever wanted."
"I'm safe," she said. "I'm fine." When Christina spoke again, her voice was softer. Probably just the thought of a pill working its way through her bloodstream had calmed her.
"I expect you to call me first thing in the morning."
"I will," Jem said. "Just tell Dad not to worry." Christina hesitated.
"I'll see what I can do."
Gemma hung up. She was